He could not experiment with uranium without protection from it. I've seen men turn blotchy from it, he added, which was true, but not of his present crew. This seemed to cheer Turl up.
No crap, he said.
What gear protects one? Turl said,
There's always radiation around on a planet like this and a sun like this. Small amounts. That's why these breathe masks have leaded glass in their faceplates. That's why all the canopies are leaded glass. You don't have any.
It's lead that protects one?
You'll just have to take your chances,
said Turl, amused, feeling better. Can you turn a light up here? Asked Johnny. There was a thump as he laid a sack on the flat section in front of the window screen.
I don't want any lights.
Do you think you were followed?
No. That spinning disc on the roof is a detection wave neutralizer. You needn't worry about our being traced.
Johnny looked up at the top of the tank. In the very dim light, he could see a thing planted there. It looked like a fan. It was running.
Turn a light on this, said Johnny.
Turl looked at his screens. There were no telltales.
I'll drive ahead under that tree.
Johnny steadied the ore sack as Turl slowly put the car under a mask of evergreens. He stopped again and turned on a light that lit up the area in front of the windshield. With a lift of his arm, Johnny spilled about 10 pounds of ore onto the tank bonnet. It flashed under the light. It was white quartz and wire gold. And it shone and glittered as though it had jewels in it as well. 8 pounds of it was pure wire gold from the load. Turl sat and stared through the windscreen at it. He swallowed hard.
There's a ton of it there, said Johnny, if it can be gotten out. It's in plain view.
The cyclo just sat there and looked at the gold through the windscreen. Johnny scattered it so it shone better. He picked up the intercom again.
We're keeping our bargain. You must keep yours. What do you mean?
Said Turl, detecting accusation. You promised to give food and water and firewood to the females. Turl shrugged.
Promises,
he said indifferently. Johnny put his arm around the gold and started to sweep it back into the ore sack and withdraw it. The motion was not lost on Turl.
Quit it. How do you know they aren't being cared for?
Johnny let the gold lie. He moved over so the light touched his face. He tapped a finger against his forehead.
There's something you don't know about humans, said Johnny. They have psychic powers sometimes. I have psychic powers with those females.
It would not do to tell Turl that it was the absence of a fire or a scout that alerted him. All's fair in love and war, as Robert the Fox would say, and this was both love and war.
You mean without radios, right?
Turl had read about this. He hadn't realized these animals had it.
Damned animals.
Right, said Johnny. If she is not well cared for, and if she isn't all right, I know. He tapped his head again. Now, I have a pack here, said Johnny. It has food and water and flints and firewood and warm robes and a small tent. I'm going to lash it on top of this tank, and right away when you get back, you're to put it in the cage. Also, get the cage cleaned up, inside and outside, and fix the water supply.
It's just the tank, said Turl. It goes empty, needs to be topped up. I've been busy.
And take those sentries away. You don't need sentries.
How did you know there were sentries?
Said Turl, suspiciously.
You just told me so tonight, said Johnny into the intercom.
And my psychic powers tell me they tease her.
You can't order me around, bristled Turl.
Turl, if you don't take care of the females, I just might take it into my head to wander up to those sentries and mention something I know.
What? Demanded Turl.
Just something I know. It wouldn't cause you to be fired, but it would be embarrassing. Turl suddenly vowed he had better get rid of those sentries.
You'll know if I don't do these things, said Turl.
Johnny tapped his own forehead in the light. but the threat had unsettled Turl's spinning wits. On an entirely different tack, he demanded,
"What'll you do with the gold if you don't deliver it?"
"Keep it for ourselves," said Johnny, starting again to put it back in the bag.
Turl snarled deep and threateningly. His amber eyes flared in the darkness of the tank.
"I'll be damned if you will," he shouted. "Leverage, leverage. Listen, did you ever hear of a drone bomber?" "Ha! I thought not. Well, let me tell you something, animal. I can lift off a drone bomber and send it right over that site, right over your camp, right over any shelter and bomb you out of existence. All by remote. You're not as safe as you think, animal."
Johnny just stood there, looking at the blank, black windows of the tank as the words avalanched through the intercom.
"You, animal," snarled Turl, "are going to mine that gold, and you're going to deliver that gold, and you are going to do it all by day 91. And if you don't, I'll blast you and all animals on this planet to hell. You hear me? To hell!"
His voice ended in a shriek of hysteria, and he stopped, panting.
"And when day 91 comes and we've done it?" said Johnny.
Turl barked a sharp, hysterical laugh. He felt he really had to get control of himself. He sensed he was acting strangely.
"Then you get paid," he shouted.
"You keep your side of the bargain," said Johnny. "We'll deliver it."
"Good," thought Turl.
He had cowed the animal. This was more like it.
"Put that pack on the tank," he said magnanimously. "I'll fill the water tank and clean up the place and take care of the sentries. But don't forget my remote control box, eh? You act up, and dead females."
Johnny tied the vital pack on the vehicle roof. In the process of doing so, he removed the wave neutralizer and put it behind a tree. Turl would think it had been knocked off by the tree branches, perhaps. It might be useful. Turl had turned the bonnet light off, and Johnny put the ore back in the sack. He knew Turl wouldn't take it with him. Without saying goodbye, Turl drove off and the tank vanished. Minutes later, when it was hidden from view and miles away, Dunnell Dean climbed out of a mine hole where he had been holding a submachine gun in sweaty hands. He had realized the weapon would do nothing to that tank, but they had not expected Turl to stay in the armored vehicle. Although they would not have shot him, they thought he might have tried to kidnap Johnny if the girls were dead. Dunnell Dean gave a short whistle. 10 more Scots bobbed into view from mine holes, putting their guns on safety. Robert the Fox came down the hill from an old ruined wall. Johnny was still standing there, looking off toward the compound.
"That demon," said Robert the Fox, "is on the verge of insanity. Did you ken how his talk darted this way and that? The hysteria and his laughter? He's hard driven by something we don't know about."
"We didn't know about the drone bombers," said Dunnell Dean.
"We know now," said Robert the Fox. "McTyler, you knew this demon. Wouldn't you say he was borderline daft?"
"Do you suppose he meant to blast you when he drove in?" asked Dunnell Dean. "But you handled it very well, Johnny McTyler."
"He's dangerous," said Johnny. 2 hours later, he saw a fire start, a tiny pinpoint of light in the distant cage. Later, a scout would confirm the removal of the sentries, and he himself would check on the water and Chrissy. An insane Turl was making this a much more hazardous game they were playing. A treacherous Turl was one thing, a maniac Turl quite another.
Chapter 9 1. The snows were late, but when they came, they made up for it with a violent, howling vengeance that almost stopped the work at the load. The staircase was not working. Johnny had helped all he could, flying an overheating platform to drive in the pins, hanging from safety wires over the yawning chasm, encouraging the others. They had almost made it, had even taken out another 90 pounds in gold, when the first real storm of winter hit them. Under winds of near hurricane force, driving frozen pellets as hard as bullets, almost shaking the very mountains themselves, the staircase had collapsed. Fortunately, it had just been abandoned during a shift change when it went, and there were no casualties. They were waiting now for a lull in the storm to see what else they could do. It was mandatory that they appear industrious, for it was the opinion of Robert the Fox that Turl would not act violently unless it appeared there was no hope. But just now the driving snow masked any pictures the recon drone might take in its daily overfly. Besides, it was not vital, they all assured him, that Johnny be there. Long ago, the planning had provided that three who looked like him keep up the appearance that he was always there. One of these three was always visible to the recon drone, each one to his own watch. It had even been Thor who had held up the sign, not Johnny. Three watches were vital, for no crew could stand it for more than 2 hours in this bitter cold. So Johnny was not there today. Through the driving storm, he and three others were heading for a place once called Yuravan. The historian, Dr. McDermott, was developing quite a knack for picking up information out of the tattered remains of books. He even had a young Scot, an accomplished scout, assigned to him now just to go off and dig up ancient maps and books. And McDermott had found a reference that said that Yuravan had one of the world's largest uranium deposits. It was supposed to be west and slightly south of the base, about 220 miles, and just beyond and a bit southwest of an enormous, distinctive plateau. Uranium. So Johnny and one of the pilots and Angus McTavish were on their way in a personnel plane. Who knew? They might be lucky. Angus McTavish was delighted. He was the one who figured out man mechanics and got things working. Johnny had trained him and another half-dozen Scots in electronics, and they were all good at that and mechanics, but it was Angus McTavish who was the star. Pugnacious, never knowing the meaning of defeat, a bundle of enthusiastic black-haired optimism, Angus was quite certain they would find mountains of uranium right there, all ready to shovel into a bag and cart off. Johnny didn't think so. In the first place, they had no protection from radiation yet, so they were a long way from solving anything. But a uranium mine might have enough left around to test breathe gas. He wisely refrained from dampening Angus's enthusiasm. All they were out for was, in fact, a scout to find a place to test breathe gas. The storm made visibility very poor. The passenger craft bucketed along, battered by the machine gunning of occasional local storms. The plane had damn all in the way of instruments, and it was all contact flying. A time or two, a peak would flash by a mite too close, but from way up high it was a carpet of turbulent whiteness, and one might lose his bearings. Fortunately, the storm was blowing eastward, and its worst furies were past by the time they had gone 100 miles. They burst out of a cloud into clear weather. The panorama of the western Rockies spread out, glistening in the late morning sun, breathtaking in its beauty. "Scotland may be the best land in the world," said the co-pilot, "but 'tis never like this." Johnny punched their speed up to about 500, and the white vast world fled by. He spotted the plateau, estimated from the ancient schoolbook map he held where Yuravan might be. Even in the snow, they could make out where an ancient curving road had been. He spotted the southeast point where the road forked and, down to treetop level and counting the white-coated remains of towns, brought them to the mounds and dumps that must be Yuravan. He landed in front of some buildings, the plane crunching into the fresh snow. Angus McTavish was out of the door like a running buck, his kilt flying behind him. He dashed into one ruined building after another, and suddenly came speeding back. His voice thin in the sharp air, he yelled, "'Tis Yuravan!" He held up some tattered scraps of paper. Johnny reached him back and got out a breathe gas cartridge and the equipment. He and Angus had worked half the night making a remote control that would turn the regulator on and off. All they had to do was find a hot radiation spot, back off, turn on the remote, and see whether they got a flash of exploding breathe gas. Johnny also got out some shovels, climbing ropes, and mine lamps. Running all over the place like a hunting hound, Angus was tracking down likely spots. There were ore dumps. There had been fences, but these had long since rusted away. They tried repeatedly. They would scoop out an old dump and put the breathe gas cartridge down, back off, release some breathe gas, and see whether it flashed in a small explosion. After a dozen tries, Angus became convinced it must be a spent cartridge. He switched it on in front of his face and promptly turned blue with coughing. No, it wasn't a spent cartridge. They went down in pits. They scrambled into drifts long since unsafe. They used up 5 cartridges of breathe gas. No explosions. Johnny felt a bit disheartened. He let Angus and the pilot go on with the experiments while he wandered around through the ruins. It was all so badly decayed, there was difficulty in recognizing what the buildings had been used for. How Angus had found paper simply added up to Angus. It must have been protected by being preserved under something. Then Johnny started to get suspicious. In all this area, he had only found one pitiful remnant that might have been a body, merely teeth fillings and buttons lying in a certain pattern in a room. No remains of file cabinets. No distinguishable remains of machinery, aside from some decayed hoists. But no bodies, save that one. He went back to the plane and sat down. This place had been mined out before the cyclo attack, and it had been mined out with such care that the waste dumps weren't even hot. Angus came streaming back, shouting, "It works! It works!" He was carrying something that had been framed. Johnny got out and looked at it. One corner of the ancient frame was not charred. Inset into the dilapidated mounting was a piece of ore. It had a brass plate under it, mostly undecipherable. There must have been a leaded glass face on the frame once, for a scrap of it remained in a corner. He carried it over to a rock and sat down and studied it. The ore was brown and black. It had been mounted as an exhibit on a lead background. He held the inscription this way and that. He couldn't make out more than that it was the first something. And then a person's name he couldn't make out either. He turned the plate in another way, and then saw the letters at the top more plainly. They said, "Pitch Blend."
"Look," said Angus. "Let me show you."
He took the frame from Johnny and put it about 30 feet away. He pointed the breathe gas cartridge at it and came back to Johnny. He flipped on a remote switch. The breathe gas emission exploded.
"I'll do it again,"
yelped Angus. He turned the switch full on and left it on. He wouldn't have had time to turn it off anyway. The bottle, its emitting snout flaming like a rocket engine, took off and went about 10 feet. The pilot and Angus shouted with delight. "Pitch Blend," said Johnny, who had done a lot of homework. "That's uranite ore. It's the source of a lot of radioactive isotopes. Where'd you get it?" They dragged him off to the broken shambles of a building that was so collapsed they had to tug and pull at a lot of roof to get at anything else in it. Covered with dust and hot from work despite the chill air, Johnny at last went out and sat on what had once been a porch. A museum. A small museum, it had been. Other specimens were there. Rose quartz, hematite, things that weren't from this immediate place. There wasn't even any evidence that the pitch blend had been from here.
"The test for breathe gas works," said the irrepressible Angus.
Johnny felt depressed. He knew it worked. He had seen a blade scraper canopy blow up and kill a cyclo long ago when some radioactive dust hit it. "I'm glad it works," he said. "But even if there is any uranium left under us, it's too deep for us to get to. Collect some more lead and wrap that specimen up. We'll take it home."
"Let's look around here some more," said Angus.
Johnny had to wait out the storm to the east anyway. "Go ahead," he said. But he knew it was mined out. Only one body and a museum.
Where in heaven's name was he going to find uranium? Lots of it. Where? 2. Johnny gazed with horror into the deep canyon. There was a flying drill platform down there, close to the river, and it was in real trouble. It was the day after their return from Uravan. The storm had blown over, leaving a sparkling, white-coated day. But at these altitudes it was bitterly cold, and the canyon, as ever, was funneling winds into torrents of turbulence. Two Scots, one of them Dunnell Dean, the other a black-haired youth named Andrew, were down on that platform trying to recover the staircase, which had fallen 900 feet down into the frozen river. 60 feet long and built of rods, it had pierced the river ice, leaving an end on the bank. They had grappled the end with a hook, lowered from the flying drill platform, and had tried to fly the staircase up and out of the river. It was caught under water. Now sprays, coming up through the broken ice, were coating the platform with water that instantly froze, increasing the platform's weight by the moment. He knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to look busy for the benefit of the recon drone that would be there in a moment or two. The rest of the shift crew were strung out along the chasm's edge, untangling the masses of cables and drums that had been scrambled by the storm. Dunnell Dean and Andrew had gone down there to look busy salvaging the staircase. Johnny had been returning in the small passenger plane to work out some new method of getting the gold. He didn't have a co-pilot. He had only old Dr. McDermott, the historian, who had begged a ride so that he could come up to the load and write the saga of the storm. The ancient Scot, who had considered himself expendable at the recruiting, was a very wise and valued dean of literature, but he was not in the slightest bit trained in their work, and frail beyond estimation, with hardly the muscle and skill one needed. There was no time at all to drop down and pick up a trained and agile Scot from the site on the cliff. They were using local radios. All the items of equipment had them built in, for their range and the range of mine intercoms was only a mile. The transmissions were also masked by the mountains to the east. The radio down there on the platform was evidently open.
"Throw off the real brakes, Andrew," Dunnell Dean was saying tensely. "The motors are overheating. They will not disengage. 'Tis the spray. Andrew, disengage the hooks to that staircase. They will not budge, Dunnell Dean, and the thing is stuck under the ice."
The whine of the overloaded motors was also coming through the open mics. Johnny knew what was going to happen. They couldn't fly the platform free. They couldn't drop down into the rolling, freezing water, and that platform was going to go up in flames any moment. Such a platform had rudimentary flying controls, usually covered by a lead glass canopy. But the humans didn't use the canopies, and Dunnell Dean was down there in the midst of flying spray that was coating not only himself, but also the controls, with instant ice. The recon drone would be by in another second or two. It must see efforts to mine, not disaster. Johnny could hear its nearing rumble outside his open side port. Its hypersonic explosion would occur any moment now. The instant it went by, he would have to somehow get those two off that platform.
"Dr. Mack," shouted Johnny into the rear of the plane, "get ready. You're about to be a hero."
"Oh, my goodness," said Dr. McDermott.
"Open the side door and throw out two lifelines," shouted Johnny. "Make sure our ends are secure to this ship."
The old man scrambled about, grabbing at unfamiliar coils and tangles of cables in the rear.
"Hold on," shouted Johnny.
He sent the passenger craft plummeting 1,000 feet into the racketing, wind-blasting roar of the chasm. The walls flashed by. Dr. McDermott's stomach stayed 1,000 feet up. The nearby white and red blur of canyon walls streaked past the open door, and he stared at it open-mouthed, barely able to hold on. Johnny cracked open the plane's radio.
"Dunnell Dean," he yelled into the mic, "stand by to abandon that thing."
There was the crack of the sonic boom. The recon drone had passed. Dunnell Dean's fur-hooded face was looking up,
and Johnny realized it was not for the passenger plane, but for the benefit of the drone, so Turl would suppose it was Johnny there. Smoke was coming from the platform motor housings, blue smoke, different from the geysers of spray. The ice-pressured river was taking full advantage of the hole just made to geyser its way to freedom. Andrew was pounding on the encrusted winch with a sledge. Then he dropped the sledge and seized a bottle of burning gas and tried to open its controls in order to burn the cable in two. The bottle was thick with ice and it would not open. The passenger plane came down to 25 feet from the top of the platform, Johnny madly punching control buttons to hold it there. Smoke from the burning motors of the platform swirled chokingly into the plane above.
"Dr. Mack," shouted Johnny, "throw out those lifelines."
The old man fumbled with the coils. He could not tell one cable from another. Then he found an end. He pitched it out the door. Scrambling, he let about 50 feet on a coil and then fastened the cable to a clamp in the plane as best he could. Johnny maneuvered the cable end over the spray-battered platform.
"I cannot find another cable end,"
wailed Dr. McDermott. Johnny shouted into the mic,
"Grab that rope!"
"You, Andrew!"
shouted Donald Dean. 20 feet of cable from the plane coiled down on the platform and was promptly covered with spray that instantly turned to ice. Andrew took a turn of cable around his arm.
"Don't put it around your arm!" shouted Johnny.
If Donald Dean were below him, the tightening of the rope would break or sever Andrew's arm.
"Put it around that sledgehammer!"
Tongues of flame were coming from the motor housing of the platform. Andrew managed to break the sledge loose from the ice. He took 2 turns of cable around the head of it.
"Grab hold!" yelled Johnny.
Andrew grabbed the slippery sledge handle with his mittened hands. Johnny jumped the passenger plane up 20 feet, pulling Andrew up and leaving the end of the cable dangling over Donald Dean.
"The captain abandoned ship,"
said Donald Dean and grabbed the cable end. Johnny put the passenger plane up slowly. It would not do to whip-snap the 2 men off into the roiling river to be swept under the ice. Andrew was hanging to the sledge 20 feet below the passenger plane. Donald Dean was dangling 40 feet below on the same rope.
"I think this clamp is slipping,"
wailed Dr. McDermott in the back. The iced mittens of the men below were certainly slipping. It was impossible to raise them 1,000 feet to the top of the gorge. Johnny looked wildly at the river. The flying platform below exploded in a violence of orange flame. The passenger plane bucked in the concussion. Johnny looked down at the men. The flames had hit Donald Dean. His leggings were on fire. Johnny swept the plane downriver. With frantically racing fingers, he brought it to 45 feet above the snow-coated ice of the stream. Was that ice thick enough? He dipped the plane. Donald Dean struck the deep snow. Johnny dragged him 100 feet through the drifts on the river to put the fire out. He saw a shelf beside the river, narrow and snow-covered. Bringing the plane within feet of the canyon wall, he lowered Donald Dean onto it and then dropped further. Andrew's gloves, which had been slipping down the sledge handle inch by inch, let go, and he fell the last 10 feet. He almost went off the ledge. Donald Dean grabbed him. Johnny, battling the wind, turned the plane around and brought the open door to the ledge. The 2 men scrambled in, helped by Dr. McDermott. Andrew reeled in the cable and got the side door shut. Johnny vaulted the plane 2,000 feet up and maneuvered to land at the pad on the top. Dr. McDermott was stammering with apologies to the 2 men.
"I couldn't find a second rope."
"Think nothing of it,"
said Donald Dean.
"I even got a sleigh ride out of it."
Dr. McDermott was clucking over his charred leggings, terribly relieved to find Donald Dean was just singed and not badly burned.
"I had my chance to be a hero,"
said Dr. McDermott,
"and I muffed it."
"You did just fine," said Andrew. "Just fine."
Johnny got out of the plane and walked over to the canyon edge. They followed him. The shift crew was also staring down, their faces shiny from the perspiration of strain. It had been a wild thing to watch. Shaking his head, Johnny looked down 1,000 feet to where the edge of the staircase was embedded in the bank. The flying platform had vanished under the ice. The snow around the place was pockmarked with the impacts of broken bits and blackened from the explosion. Johnny faced Dunaldine and the crew.
"That," said Johnny, "is that."
The shift boss and Dunaldine said, almost in chorus,
"But we can't quit."
"No more of these acrobatics in thin air," said Johnny. "No more hanging over this edge with our hearts in our throats. Come with me." They followed him back to the pad. He pointed straight down. "Below us," said Johnny, "that vein is extending into the cliff. It's a pocket vein. Pockets of gold probably occur every few hundred feet. We're going to put a shaft down to that vein. Then we're going to drift along that vein underground to the cliff edge and try to recover that gold from behind." They were silent. "But that fissure out there, we can't blast. It would knock the face of the cliff off. We're just going to have to use drills, point drills to go in with parallel holes, then vibrating spades to literally cut the rock. It will take time. We can work hard and maybe get there."
Underground?
It dawned on them it was a great idea. The shift boss and Dunaldine started making plans to fly in drilling machinery and scrapers and bucket conveyors. Waves of relief began to spread. The shift change crew flew in, and when they heard about it, they cheered. They had hated hanging by their heels in greedy space with little return to show. "Get it set up and rolling before the next passover of the drone," said Johnny. "Turl's gone crazy, but he's a miner. He'll see what we're doing and hold off. It's like taking rock out with teaspoons, so we'll work this all 3 shifts around the clock. It'll be easier to work underground in this weather anyway. We'll use the dig out to enlarge this flat space. Now, where's a transit so we can get the exact direction down and over for the dig?" The sound of the plane revved up. Dunaldine was going back for pilots and equipment.
"We might make it yet," thought Johnny.
3. A worried Zit was watching Turl and a swarm of mechanics working over the old bomber drone. The huge underground garages and hangars resounded with the whine of drills and clang of hammers. Since the last semi-annual personnel intake, Zit had gotten his mechanics back. Aside from exchanging recon drones for refueling every 3 days, a drone he considered useless, his work was not backlogged. Turl had left the transport chief and section alone until now. Turl himself had serviced the 20 battle planes in the outside field. So aside from this present unexpected project, Zit had little about which to complain. But this idiocy, the bomber drone? He knew he had better speak. Turl was in the huge plane's control room, working with presets of buttons. He was covered with grease and sweat. He had a small remote keyboard in his hand, and he was punching settings into the main panels of the ship.
"Scotland, Sweden," Turl was saying, consulting his tables and notes and pushing ship buttons.
There were no seats in the place, for it would never be piloted, and Turl was hunched uncomfortably on a balance motor housing.
"Russia, Alps, Italy, China, no, Alps, India, China, Italy, Africa."
"Turl," said Zit timidly.
"Shut up,"
snapped Turl, not even looking up.
"Amazon, Andes, Mexico, Rocky Mountains, Rocky Mountains 1, 2, and 3.
"Turl," repeated Zit. "This bomber drone has not been flown in 1,000 years. It's a wreck."
"We're rebuilding it, aren't we?"
snarled Turl, finishing his presets and standing up. "Turl, maybe you don't know that this was the original conquest drone. It was the one that gassed this planet before our takeover."
"Well, I'm loading it with gas canisters, ain't I?"
"But, Turl, we've already conquered this planet 1,000 or more years ago."
You release kill gas now, even in just a few places, and it might hit our own mine sites.
They use breathe gas,
snapped Turl, shouldering by Zt and walking back into the huge plain. Workmen were trundling up big gas canisters from deep underground storage. They had to burnish them gingerly to get the crud of ages off them. Turl energetically directed the workers, hooking them in place.
15 canisters. You've only brought 14. Get another one.
Some workmen rushed off, and Turl was hooking wires up to the canister release valves, muttering to himself, checking color coding.
Turl, they only kept this drone as a curiosity piece. These things are dangerous. It's one thing to remote guide a recon drone with its small motors. They don't override the controls. But this thing has motors like a dozen ore freighters. The signals it sends back to a remote get overridden by its own motors. It could charge around and release gas almost any place. They're too erratic for competent use. And once you start them, you can't stop them. Like transshipment firing, they're irreversible.
Shut up, said Turl.
In the regulations, persisted Zt, it says these things only get used in most extreme emergency. There is no emergency, Turl.
Shut up, said Turl, going on with his wire matching.
And you've ordered it permanently parked in front of the automatic firing bay. We need that for servicing ore freighters. This is a war drone, and they only use them for primary attack on a planet and never use them afterward except on a withdrawal. There is no war, and we're not withdrawing from this planet.
Turl had had enough. He threw down his notes and loomed over Zt.
I am the best judge of these things. Where there is no war department on a planet, the security chief has that post. My orders are final. This drone gets parked at the hangar firing door, and don't you move it. As to control...
He shook the small, one-foot square box in front of Zt's face.
All it needs is the date setting and firing buttons pushed in, and there's nothing erratic after that. This drone will go and do what it's supposed to do, and it stays on standby.
Zt backed up. Dollies were moving the huge old relic over to the firing door, where it would be in the way of everything and leave no other door to service freighters.
Those were awfully funny locations you were punching in, Zt said faintly.
Turl was holding a big wrench. He walked closer to Zt.
They're man names for planet locations. They're the places where man animals were left.
That little handful? Ventured Zt.
Turl screamed something and threw the wrench at him. Zt ducked, and it went clanging across the hangar floor, making workers dodge.
You're acting kind of insane, Turl, said Zt.
Only alien races ever go insane, screamed Turl.
Zt stood aside as they dollied the ancient drone to the firing door.
It's going to stay right there,
yelled Turl at nobody in particular.
It'll get fired any time in the next 4 months.
And for sure, on day 93, he smiled to himself. Zt wondered for a moment whether he ought to shoot Turl when they were in some quiet place. Turl had restored weapons to the employees, refilled the weapon racks in compound halls, let them wear belt guns again. Then he remembered that Turl had an envelope parked somewhere in case of death. Later, Zt mentioned it privately to Numpf. Zt liked to hunt, and the bomber drone would wipe out most of the game again. Numpf had also liked to hunt once. But Numpf just sat there and looked woodenly at him. The bomber drone, the one originally shipped in to gas and conquer the planet, remained standing at the firing door in everybody's way, filled with lethal gas, preset, just requiring a few punches of the remote Turl kept in his own possession. Zt shuddered every time he passed it. Turl had obviously gone stark raving mad. That night in his quarters, Turl did feel spinny. Another day, and he had gotten absolutely no clue as to what Jayed was up to, what the agent was looking for. Turl followed the recon drone photos. The animals were burrowing underground now, which was smart. They might possibly make it, and if they didn't, he had his answers. He looked in on the females every evening, throwing wood and meat at them. Sometimes he found packages outside the cage door. He chose not to think about how they got there, and threw them in too. He'd fixed the water, but so it overflowed. The bigger one was sitting up again. He never saw them without being nagged by the puzzle of psychic powers. He wondered which one of them sent out the impulses and whether they could be read on a scope. Oh, well, as long as the animals up in the mountains worked, he'd keep these females alive. It was good leverage. But on day 93, ha! He could not count on the animals not talking. He could not count on the company or government not catching up with him. The animals had to go, and this time, all of them. Turl fell asleep, floundering around in a half-conceived possibility. Jayed was denying him gold. It was Jayed's fault. But how did one commit the perfect murder of a top agent of the IBI? It made one's head spin to try to work it out. Meantime, he would be the model of efficiency. He had to look like the greatest, most cautious and alert security chief the company had ever known. Was he crazy, really? No. Just clever. 4. Johnny was going home. In a canyon above the village meadow, they unloaded 4 horses and a pack from the freight plane. The breath of the horses hung about them in small, thin puffs. The horses, very recently wild, had not liked the ride and stamped about and snorted when their blindfolds were removed. The air was clear and frosty at this altitude. Snow from the recent storm covered the world and silenced it. Angus McTavish and Parson McGilvey were with Johnny. A pilot had come along so that the plane could be moved in case the visit lasted longer than a day. The recon drone had already gone by when they took off from the base, and the plane should not be there when it passed again. A week ago, Johnny had awakened in the night with the sudden realization that he might know where some uranium was. His own village. He had no great hope for it, but the signs were there in the illness of his people. Possibly there was no great amount, but also, possibly, there was more than that single rock from Uravan. He felt a trifle guilty for having to have an ulterior motive to go home, for there were other reasons. His people should be moved, both because of their continuous exposure to radiation, and also because they should not be exposed in any future bombing. Johnny and his men had scoured the mountains for another possible home, and only yesterday had they found one. It was an old mining town on the western slope, lower in altitude, open through a narrow pass to a western plain. A brook ran down the street in the town center. Many of the buildings and houses still retained glass. Wild cattle and game were plentiful. But even better, there was a large, half-mile-long tunnel behind the town that could serve as refuge. A coal deposit was on the hill nearby. The place was beautiful. It had no trace of uranium in it. Johnny did not think the people of the village would move. He had tried before as a youth, and even his father had thought he was just being restless. But he had to try again. Angus and the parson had insisted on coming with him. He had explained the dangers of exposure to radiation to them, and had not wanted to put them at risk. But Angus simply waved a breathe gas bottle and promised to check it out ahead of them and not be foolish about it. And the parson, being a wise and experienced member of the clergy, knew Johnny might need help. They knew better than to simply fly a plane into the meadow. The people had seen recon drones all their lives, but a plane, close up, might terrify them. Part of last night had been spent planning. Angus and the parson had been briefed. There would be no action that might alarm the people. No talk of monsters. No frightening tidings about Chrissy. It would be strange enough to be seen entering from the upper canyon, for the pass on the eastern side of the meadow and all such passes were now choked with snow. And so they rode, three mounted men and a heavily laden pack horse, down into the meadow. The horse's hoofs made little sound in the loose snow. The deserted cabins on the outskirts were dilapidated and forlorn. Only a whiff of pungent wood smoke was in the air. Where were the dogs? Johnny drew up. The corral where horses were kept was empty. Then he listened carefully and heard a stamp in the old barn sheds beyond. There was a horse there, possibly more than one. He looked toward the pens where wild cattle were usually driven in before the first snow. There were not many cattle there, not enough to last through the winter. Angus slid down and, as he had promised, did a test for radiation. There was no reaction directly ahead of them. Where were the dogs? True, they were not used to anything coming in the back door of the valley, but it was strange. Johnny rode on toward the courthouse below them. Angus made another test ahead of them. There was no reaction. An old hound came out of a ruin and looked at them with half-blind eyes. It came forward cautiously, belly deep in the snow. It approached Johnny, sniffing hard, wisps of vapor rising from its nose. Then it began to wag its tail, coming closer, wagging harder and harder until the tail was almost whipping the dog's face as he doubled on himself with greeting. The hound began to yelp with welcome. Three or four more dogs sounded down in the village center. Johnny dismounted to pat the hound. It was Panther, one of his family's dogs. He walked on, leading the horse, the dog rheumatically trying to cavort about him. A gaunt-eyed child peered at them from the corner of a building and then ran off, stumbling and falling in the snow. Johnny stopped at the courthouse and looked in. The door was off its hinges and the place was empty and cold. Snow had drifted well into the main room. He came out and surveyed the scene of the quiet, ruined village. He saw smoke coming from the roof of his family's house and walked over to it. He knocked. There were sounds within, and then the door cracked open. It was his Aunt Ellen. She just stood there, staring through the slit. Then,
"Johnny?"
And then,
"But you're dead, Johnny."
She opened the door wide and stood there crying. After a little, she wiped her eyes with a doeskin apron.
"Come in, Johnny. I kept your room, but we gave your things to the young men. Come in. The cold is getting in the house."
"Is there illness in the village?" said Johnny, thinking of his companions.
"Oh, no. Nothing unusual. There was a deer seen on the hills, and the men are all up there trailing it. There's not too much food, Johnny. Not since you went away."
Then she realized it sounded like an accusation.
"I mean..."
She was crying again. Johnny felt a tug at his heartstrings. She was growing old before her time. She was gaunt, her face bones showing too plainly. Johnny brought in Angus and the parson, and they warmed themselves at the fire. Aunt Ellen had never seen a stranger before in her life, and she was a little frightened. But she acknowledged the introductions and then busied herself getting them some hot soup made from boiled bones, and they said it was very good. She stopped flashing questioning glances at Johnny and was pleased with them.
"Chrissy found you?"
she finally ventured to ask. "Chrissy is alive," said Johnny. "So is Patty. No alarm. Don't alarm them."
"I'm so glad. I was so worried. But she would ride off. Your horse eventually came back, you know."
She started to cry again, and then came over and gave Johnny a violent hug. She went off to prepare beds for them in case they spent the night. Johnny went out and found the small child who had spotted them, and sent him up the hill to recall the party that had been after the deer. It was past 4 when he finally got the town council assembled. He was surprised that it was only old Jimson and Brown Limper's staffer. The third member had died recently and no other was appointed. Johnny had gotten a fire going in the courthouse and propped the door back up. He introduced Angus and the parson, and the town council acknowledged them a bit worriedly. Like Aunt Ellen, they had never before seen strangers. But Angus and the parson withdrew inconspicuously to the side. Johnny made his business known to the town council. No alarm. He told them he had discovered the valley was unhealthy, and that was why they had so few children and so many deaths, and that he had originally gone off to find a better location and had finally done so. The new town was very nice. It had water available in the main street, and less snow and more game and better houses and even some black rock that burned very hot, and it was a very nice place. It was a good plea and very well presented. Old Jimson was interested and looked very favorable. He consulted with Brown Limper, as was correct. Brown Limper held old grudges against Johnny. Look what had happened. Johnny had gone off, and this had drawn away Chrissy and Patty, probably to their deaths. And now here was Johnny Goodboy Tyler turned up a year and a half or more later with some demand that they move their homes. These were their homes. They had always been safe here, and that was that. They took a vote. It was a tie. The town council didn't know what to do. There used to be a village assembly, a town meeting, said Johnny. There hasn't been one in all my life, said Brown Limper. Yes, I know of those, said Jimson. One was held 30 years ago to change the location of the stock pens. As the council is tied, said Johnny, it should call a town meeting. Brown Limper didn't like it, but there was nothing else they could do. By this time, several people had drifted by from curiosity, and Johnny had no trouble sending word out to collect the people into the courthouse. It was 5 and dark when they all came. Johnny had gotten more wood and built up the fire. He knew better than to light a miner's lamp for illumination. When, at last, he looked at them, sitting on benches and on the floor, faces bathed in the firelight of the smoky room, he felt very bad. They were a beaten people. They were gaunt, some of them ill. The children were too quiet. There were only 28 now. A flaming rage at the cyclos surged up in him. He made himself very calm. He smiled at them when he felt more like weeping. Johnny began, with the council's permission, by opening up his pack. There were gifts. He handed out some dried meat, some bundles of kinnikinick for food flavoring, and some very live flints that would strike long trains of sparks. The people found these very acceptable and thanked him. Then Johnny took out some stainless steel axes and showed them what they would do by cutting a large piece of firewood with one blow. The people were impressed. Johnny handed them out as presents. That done, he got out a bundle of stainless steel knives. When he showed how they cut, warning them not to cut their fingers, the women were quite excited. He handed those around. Finally, he got down to business and told them all about the new town and how easy it would be to move. He didn't tell them they would be flown to it, for he knew he would have sacrificed credibility. No one asked questions when they were invited. Johnny had a foreboding. He took a triangle of broken glass from his pouch and showed them that you could see through it. He told them that in the new town, a lot of the windows had this in them, and it let light in and kept the cold out. He passed the glass around. A little boy cut himself on it slightly, and the glass was quickly handed back. He told them this valley was making them ill, that it had a poison in it that made it difficult to have children. With a pleading look on his face, he let old Jimson put it to a vote. All those in favor of moving, count. All those in favor of staying here, count. 3 in favor, 15 against. They wouldn't count the children. Johnny would not let it go. He rose. Please tell me, he demanded of them, why you take this decision. An elderly man, Torrance Marshall, rose, looked around to see whether it was all right, and then spoke.
This is our home. We are safe here. We thank you for the gifts. We are glad you are home.
He sat down. Brown Limper looked smug. The people wandered off quietly to their suppers. Johnny sat down. He held his head in his hands, defeated. He felt the parson's hand on his shoulder.
"'Tis seldom," said the parson, "that a man is a king in his own country."
"It's not that," said Johnny. "It's just that..." He couldn't finish. Over and over in his head went the words, "My poor people. Oh, my poor people." Later that night, he went up to the knoll where the cemetery had been. He searched through the snow until he found the cross of his father's grave. It had fallen over. He put it back in place and scratched the name on it. For a long, cold time, he stood looking down at the slight mound. His father had seen no sense in moving the village. Were all his people going to die here? The bitter winter wind moaned down from High Peak. 5.
Wake up, Johnny! Wake up! It flushed!
Johnny pried himself awake. It was still dark, though dawn was late at this season of the year. It was disorienting to find himself in his own room with Angus shaking him and a miner's light burning on the table. Suddenly he grasped the import of what Angus was saying and got up and began to get into his buckskins. Angus had awakened very early and had been thirsty, and Aunt Ellen had heard him clattering around the buckets. There had been no water, and Angus didn't like eating snow, so Aunt Ellen had said she would go get some water. But Angus said no, he'd get the water if she showed him where it was, and she pointed out the spring where everybody got their water on the edge of the village, and he took a hide bucket and went. Because he'd promised Johnny not to go anywhere without testing, he'd taken a vial of breathe gas and the remote, and he had been tossing the breathe gas bottle 30 feet ahead of him and turning it on and off, and wham, it flashed. Hopping about with excitement, Angus was handing Johnny bits of clothing to rush him on. He pushed Johnny out the door and they walked toward the spring at the village edge. Angus stopped him. He triggered the remote. Wham! There was a flash and thud of breathe gas exploding. The parson, awakened by the commotion, joined them. Angus did it again for his benefit. A sudden chill came over Johnny, and not from the morning cold. That flash was right alongside the path where the villagers went 2 and 3 times a day for water. And more. As a little boy, he had been a mutineer on a subject of what work he would do. He was a man, he had said, illogically, since he had begun this soon after he could walk, and he would hunt, but he would not sweep floors or bring water. And he had never fetched water from that spring. He had even watered his horses at another spring way up the slope. The chill came from his certainty that he himself was not immune to radiation. He had simply never gone to that spring. By a fluke, he had escaped contamination. All because hide buckets slopped on him. But the villagers, particularly the children and women and older people who did draw water, were daily being hit with radiation. He felt a deeper chill for his people. Angus wanted to dash up and dig under the snow. Johnny, aided by the parson, held him back. "We've no protective shields," said Johnny. "We need lead, lead glass, something. But let's mark this out so it becomes a prohibited zone, and then let's look further." They found, by cautious sallies, that the radiation from that spot extended with enough force to explode breathe gas about 30 feet in all directions. Angus apparently had hit it dead center. They marked the ring with ashes taken from an abandoned cabin hearth, and with an axe, Johnny collected some stakes and drove them in to form a circle. Johnny took some plaited rope and wound it around the stakes. Jimson, along with some others attracted by the explosions, wanted to know what they were doing. Johnny left it to the parson. As he worked, he heard fragments of the parson's explanation, something about spirits. But whatever it was, Jimson shortly began to route people around the spot in a businesslike way.